Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. One word, four letters, the theme of the program today, J-O-B-S. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 6th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, there are days on which it can be useful to just take a step back and not worry about this story of the day or that story of the day, and to just try to get a big picture sense of what's going on here. And as you might have guessed, we have decided that today is one of those days, because there's a lot going on out there right now, right? The virus, both the Delta and Omicron varieties, supply chains still clogged and complicated, prices still rising. And as we talked about a lot on Friday, jobs. What the what? There are still lots of them open and workers still coming off the pandemic sidelines to fill them. So, in view of all that, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going today with the first of a labor market three-parter, jobs and what is going on in this economy.
Every month since June, employers have posted more than 10 million job openings, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Online job site Indeed, which is a marketplace underwriter, tracks openings in near real time. Economist Ann Elizabeth Conkle says job postings are now running more than 50% above pre-pandemic.
We have human resource job postings. They are up 119% compared to their pre-pandemic baseline. That is a huge number and shows that employers have a really strong appetite to hire people who will help hire others for their businesses.
Once hired, workers aren't very likely to get laid off. John Lear at polling firm Morning Consult says workers know from friends and family that layoffs are down.
And as fewer and fewer people around them lose their jobs, that helps people feel more secure about their economic future.
Lear says folks returning to work after long bouts of pandemic unemployment may not feel so secure yet, especially in service jobs like delivery driver, nail salon employee, waiter, or short order cook. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
More Mitchell coming up in a bit, but as he was talking about there at the end, the service sector in this economy, it has had a rough haul, as we've all spent most of the past almost 2 years now, if you can believe it, buying way more stuff than services. We'll get the November Consumer Price Index on Friday, another snapshot of just how much inflation is affecting the cost of everyday life, including going out to eat. So with that in mind, Marketplace's Kristen Schwab made some restaurant calls.
There's plenty for Raimi Rosello to be happy about these days. Hiring at her Mexican restaurant, Comida, in Aurora, Colorado, has gotten easier. It'll let her reopen 7 days a week. And the average table is spending more.
No, not just because prices are higher, but maybe they're drinking a little bit more.
But the higher prices are affecting her business. The cost of avocados, limes, and meat are up. She's had to increase menu prices 15% and added a service fee because she's also paying her employees more. And lately, there have been fewer customers. She's not sure if it's because of Omicron or because there's been little snow, which means less snow tourism.
I mean, there's a lot of things to be a little freaked out about.
Inflation and slowing sales are the two biggest worries right now, says Sean Kennedy at the National Restaurant Association. Spending is still below what it was pre-pandemic, and he's unsure of how much that'll change.
All of us are looking into crystal balls and trying to identify what is the new normal.
He does say takeout and delivery are here to stay. That's good for Shaz Khan, who owns Tono Pizzeria and Cheesesteaks in the Twin Cities. He has three locations with two more opening next year, if he can get what he needs to outfit the spaces.
A lot of the materials we need, all the way from construction materials to, you know, fittings and furnishings, they're delayed.
But he's optimistic. He feels like he's made it through the worst of the pandemic, even though he's a bit stressed about sourcing Philly-style sandwich rolls and mozzarella cheese. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, help me out here, will you? Because honestly, I've lost track. Were the gains today a bounce back from a drubbing or a rally just cause? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hey, here's a phrase you maybe haven't heard in a while. HELOC. Yes, no, not a word, an acronym technically, but you know what I mean. Home Equity Lines of Credit, HELOC, right, were all the rage during the last housing boom as people barred against the rising equity they had in their homes, and they used the proceeds to pay for all kinds of stuff, some of which were actually housing-related. We all know how that worked out, which is one reason that if you want to take out a HELOC right now, you might have a little bit of trouble, as Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
As of mid-year, American homeowners had amassed $23.6 trillion in equity. That's the estimated value of their homes minus how much they owe on their mortgages.
It's astounding. That's up $3 trillion just in the last year.
That's Mike Frattantoni, chief economist with the Mortgage Bankers Association. To bring those numbers down to earth a bit, that's an average gain of more than $51,000 per household, according to CoreLogic. A common way to tap some of that equity used to be a home equity line of credit, or HELOC. It works sort of like a credit card, but with typically lower rates and your house as collateral. But while equity keeps growing thanks to rising home prices, HELOC balances have been falling for most of the past decade.
Bank regulation really tightened up after the financial crisis a dozen years ago. So that's led banks to be more cautious with respect to HELOCs, and credit criteria are tighter.
Frattantoni says homeowners are more cautious too.
I think anyone who lived through the great financial crisis is just a little wary about drawing against home equity with concerns that it might not hold up.
Those concerns flared up at the start of the pandemic when millions lost their jobs and no one could predict how well the housing market would hold up. Several big banks, including Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, stopped offering HELOCs altogether. But even as the economy has recovered and housing has boomed, those banks still aren't accepting applications.
My guess is that the demand for this product simply evaporated given how low rates are.
Lori Goodman co-directs the Urban Institute's Housing Finance Policy Center. With 30-year mortgage rates falling below 3% for much of the past year, she says it makes more sense for homeowners who want to tap their equity to do a cash-out refinance. That's when you take out a new, larger mortgage, pay off the old one, and pocket the difference, usually at a fixed rate.
By contrast, HELOCs are floating rate instruments, so it is less attractive to take on a floating rate loan at a higher rate than a generational low in a fixed rate.
Cash out refis are up 33% from a year ago, according to mortgage data firm Black Knight.
It's not anywhere close to what it was in the financial crisis, but certainly you are seeing more of it than you've seen at any time since the financial crisis.
But interest rates are expected to rise in the coming year as the Fed responds to worrisome inflation, and that will make refinancing make less sense. People who want to keep the low fixed rate on their mortgage may look for other ways to tap their equity, and lenders will be looking for other revenue streams. Jeffrey Taylor is founder of Emphasis Digital Risk, which processes residential mortgages for large banks and other lenders. He says as mortgage rates have crept back above 3% in the past few months, he's already seeing growing demand for HELOCs.
For two of our customers, we've seen the volume triple in the last 3 months. Other customers are planning to launch in 2022. So there is so much home equity available that everybody is going to be looking to lend in that space.
And with the supply of homes to buy still so tight, he expects a lot of demand from people fixing up or expanding their current houses and staying put. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Talented though Mitchell Hartman is, even he can't do the American labor market justice in a mere minute-long story. The November jobs report we got on Friday had a pretty mediocre, way less than expected number for new job creation in this economy, just over 200,000, as you might remember. But there are some other indicators that paint a quite different picture. Here's Mitchell.
Employers may not have added a lot of employees in November, but they're sure adding a lot of work shifts to their existing employees and anyone they can hire. That's according to Dave Gilbertson at Payroll Processor UKG, which is a marketplace underwriter.
We're seeing a lot more people work overtime these days as employers are having a harder and harder time recruiting and hiring on new employees.
That's driving a strong sense of job security, says Chris Jackson at public opinion firm Ipsos, though not for everyone.
A lot of the insecurity, a lot of worry about losing jobs really still remains concentrated sort of on lower income people who are more affected by things like COVID shutdowns.
Upper income professionals are feeling much more confident that their jobs are secure, no matter what the pandemic throws at us next. And again, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One can't be precise about when that $1.2 trillion in infrastructure spending is actually going to start being spent. But we can tell you that the Department of Labor is already working on its part of the problem. Updates to prevailing wage regulations, the rules that make these kinds of federally funded construction jobs the good jobs that President Biden has been promising. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
It was a 1931 law called the Davis-Bacon Act that set a prevailing wage for federally funded construction projects.
It is really designed to make sure that federal purchasing power doesn't undercut local wages.
Jessica Luman is with the Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division.
We do surveys of carpenters, electricians, plumbers, and we use that to set wage determinations in each local community.
So if the government is, say, building a highway in Los Angeles, workers must be paid a minimum wage for each specific type of work in that county. Contractors can't improve their bids by, say, bringing in cheaper labor from a neighboring county or state. It's particularly important because of the nature of the industry, says Esmeralda Aguilar with North America's Building Trades Unions.
Construction workers do not work, 9 to 5, 40-hour work weeks. And so it's important that they have stability in wages.
But some construction firms warn of delays because the infrastructure bill could fund types of work that require new surveys to determine wages. Ben Brubeck is with the Associated Builders and Contractors.
It serves as a barrier, I guess, to getting some of this infrastructure money out the door and projects built quickly.
Bigger delays could come from an estimated shortfall of 430,000 workers in construction, which might push up wages even more. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They're not going to come in 5 days a week.
Which is great, but not great. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it was that kind of day where you struggle to find different ways to say rose, but let us try. The Dow Industrials jumped 646 today, 1.8%, 35,227. The NASDAQ gained 139 points. That is 0.9%, finished at 15,225. The S&P 500 pecked on 53 points, 1.1%, 45,091. Don't mind me just laughing at myself. Airlines flew higher amid a sense on Wall Street that Omicron might not be a worst-case scenario kind of thing. We're saying, of course, that it's too early to know. United lifted 8.3% today. Delta found nearly 6%. Southwest grew 2.8%. Kristen Schwab told you a little bit about the restaurant industry. So here are some. Darden Group, which counts Olive Garden and Longhorn Steakhouse among its change, finished 3% to the upside. Yum Brands, among them Taco Bell, KFC, and Pizza Hut, up 3.2%. 10-year T-note, just because you want to know. I know you do. 1.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Y'all have probably heard it so many times, you can probably recite the inflation number with me by now. Prices are up, give or take, 6% year on year. And wages are up as well, not quite as much, though. 4.8% last month. So here's Mitchell one more time.
Workers aren't just getting raises as employers scramble to keep their workers from jumping ship. And Elizabeth Conkle at Jobsite Indeed, a marketplace underwriter, says ever more posted jobs offer signing bonuses.
I have seen some that are just thousands of dollars. I mean, that's pretty substantial regardless of what sector you're in.
The reopening of schools and daycare centers is also bringing people back to work, says John Lear at Morning Consult, but they aren't necessarily building back their savings.
You know, we've got a lot of rising prices that are going to hit people at the lower end of the income spectrum because it's hitting a lot of their non-discretionary spend, like gas and groceries.
Lear says the reserves people saved up from pandemic relief checks and jobless benefits are dwindling. And for the last time this time, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I'm reasonably sure somebody at Marketplace Corporate HQ is going to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the last I heard, January was supposed to be return to office time for us. Now, with Omicron, who knows, for us and a whole lot of other places too. But long term, there's a better than even chance that hybrid is the way of the future. Some days in the office, some days at home, forever. And that, as Emily Peck wrote in Politico the other day, could mean some not great things for women in the modern workplace, specifically that they would get stuck on the mommy track.
Basically, the mommy track is this alternate path that women found themselves kind of stuck on after they became parents, and law firms and other, you know, hard-hitting white-collar workplaces gave them flexibility, time off when they needed it, but then didn't give them promotions, right, didn't advance them. So it wasn't exactly a great thing.
And it is still not. And you worry, and the point of this piece actually, is that the way we work now and for the foreseeable future, which is hybrid, Zoomy, whatever, is going to be even more challenging in a way.
Yeah, that's the worry, that the women who take advantage of this new workplace flexibility will wind up in the same old mommy track as before, despite all the advancement we thought happened since the 1980s.
Yeah, and the thing is that women, you write, the fear is that women are going to take advantage of the hybridness for a lot of reasons, main among them childcare and caregiving. They're going to choose that more than men will, and thus the this is kind of a strong word, right? But the stigma will still attach.
Yes, exactly. Women want to work more flexibly. Mm-hmm. Men want to also, don't get me wrong, but women take on more caregiving responsibilities typically. And if you're at home during the day, you can run out and do a bunch of stuff and still get all your work done. But also the potential for being stigmatized at work is greater for women. And it kind of always has been, you know, that flexibility comes with that big downside, essentially.
There's been a lot about women in the workforce and the challenges that this pandemic has brought to them. Do women, even though they slightly more than men choose the remote and hybrid work option, do they understand that that comes with a penalty, or is it like insidious, you know?
That's a really good question. I think the word choose is doing a lot of work in the question.
Yeah, yeah.
During the pandemic, so many women found they had little choice when it comes to caregiving responsibilities. So yeah, you know there's a penalty, but you still have responsibilities that you have to take on. And mm-hmm. it's hard to know how to handle it as an individual, such a systemic problem.
You can see the places where this would be an issue, right? You could see like Wall Street frowning on remote work. I mean, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, has basically said, you got to be in the office to show me you're hustling. Mm-hmm. Law firms, you could see that as well. Are there places that are doing it right, which is to say, you know, fairly and equitably?
Yeah, I mean, I have a few examples in the piece that I mentioned. I talked to the folks at Etsy and the C-suite. They're not going to come in 5 days a week. They want to avoid people coming in to curry favor yeah. with leadership. They want to set the example. So that's sort of like one thing they're doing.
Yeah, the Etsy thing is interesting, right? Because FaceTime with the boss is a perennial, ooh, you got to have it or you're not going to get promoted. And for leadership to recognize that is a net positive.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they call it, I think I name it in the piece, is proximity bias.
Right,
so
right.
Any way you can be intentional about that issue is going to be a benefit.
So look, do you work from home? What's your proximity bias, quotient?
No, that's fair. I'm 100% remote right now. Yeah. The company I work for is also 100% remote. So
yeah,
things
but,
are fine.
Well, but that's, so, but wait, but look, but that's an interesting thing, right? Because Even if you know, lots of people are in an office remote, there are some people who might be hybrid and in the office space, and you have a meeting and, you know, you're on Zoom, but the other four people in the meeting happen to be in the office that day, and you're the one who gets hosed.
Yeah, you get
right?
You get hosed. I mean, you feel left out. I spoke to a bunch of people about this. If four people are in the office and one person's at home, the advice is for everyone to hop on Zoom.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's a perfect solution because, you know, the Zoom ends and those four people are still in the office.
Right.
And they're going to talk to each other and,
right.
and they should.
Right.
So it's a problem.
And also Zoom is terrible. There's that, you know. I'm
yeah.
just saying.
We're on Zoom right now, though. It's fine. Although we have the video off, so
we kinda
it's different.
Are, yeah.
We can't see each other.
Emily Peck,
it's a bummer.
She's a content director at Fundrise, also the co-host of Slate Money. Been a journalist for a while, writing in Politico now. About the mommy track and hybrid work. Emily, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Fair to say, I think, that the uncertainty this pandemic has brought has most of us thinking about what the future might hold. Allow me to suggest, though, that remembering the past might lend some perspective to what our economic future holds. And so we come to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Josuke Ueda. My business name is Shipodo Fine Arts, and it's based in the San Francisco Bay Area. So my business is predominantly dealing in Japanese and Chinese antiques. My business started as an eBay store around 2007. I just had a collection of antiques. And in the process, a lot of customers were very curious about the history of the piece, the artist. And then slowly that eBay store transitioned to an online platform for people to sort of get more information of what they owned. So during 2020, when the shelter in place was happening, it was really stressful with the changes in smaller ends that makes the business move. It was a sort of a sense of how do I adjust and how do I survive through this? Prior to the pandemic, antique dealers, if they needed merchandise, then they could call other dealers and say, do you have this object? And then a consignment would be done. But predominantly, many of these dealers were very advanced in their age. And so once the pandemic hit, they just end up closing their business for good. And I've lost the opportunity to consign my own objects to dealers that I always consigned with. And Avenues itself was slowly disappearing. Through the pandemic, since the postal service in Japan had shut down and many of the dealers had to transition from public sectors to private sector shipping, so those costs increased for us almost about 2 to 3 times more than what the original cost has been. And if customers can't afford that much, then I have to transition into bulking the shipments. And transit times get lengthened due to that. It could end up being half a month, but prior to the pandemic, waiting times would have been at length 10 days. I want to feel optimistic, but I sort of feel cautious about what's coming next, that I just don't want to make the same mistakes as I would have learned in the past. And I hope for future generations that there will still be a sort of an intellectual interest through the encounter of an antique, that they are able to wonder about different worlds, different places, different moments in past, present, and future.
Ryosuke Ueda. He's the owner of Shapoto Fine Arts up in the San Francisco Bay Area. No matter where you are or what you do, we need you to do this series. Drop us a line, would you? Marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today. You remember all those warnings like, you know, months ago maybe, here and elsewhere, about how this winter was going to be brutal for homes heated using natural gas? Well, belay our last. Forecasts for warmer weather have decided that natural gas prices are going to have to go down. The market decides, I guess. Natural gas futures fell 11.5% today. That is 40% off the October high. And also, as my mother would say, put a sweater on. You'll be fine. All right, we're going. Here's your moment of economic context real quick. Not natural gas, but gas, the kind we buy at the pump. $3.35 for a national average, says AAA. That's like a nickel off the recent high. So it's going the right way. Our daily production team includes on the East, I mean, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.